It is possible to be a self-made millionaire. Rare, but possible. The odds are 1 in a million, of course, and entirely out of the one poor striver's control. Consider the world's top 1% hardest working people. There's still millions of people in that group, and only a tiny minority of them strike it rich. The top 1% of the top 1% of the most driven people aren't too different from the bottom 1% of the top 1% of the most driven people, if that makes any sense. There's no point you get to where you're so skilled and so superior that becoming rich is a given. It's always a roll of the dice, and those dice are loaded against you no matter what you do. When self-made rich people talk about their successes, they say they worked their ass off for years with little reward and finally it paid off. They're almost never wrong about the first part, but the story is more like they worked their ass off for years with little reward, then also won the lottery. Why did my channel blow up so fast? I basically won the lottery. Want to be rich? Skip all the bullshit. Buy a lottery ticket. And if you listen to some people, it's possible in at least one case to win that proverbial lottery again and again for no apparent reason, to go from nothing to a massive fortune without being gifted in any way simply by tripping and falling up the random ladder of fate time after time. Not talking about the subject of the previous episode. The man I'm going to talk about today had a life, supposedly, that Sam Onella Academy described as the dumbest rags-to-riches story. You might have heard of this guy. The commonly repeated story of his life goes something like this. In American Revolution era Malden, Massachusetts, there was a working-class leather worker named Timothy Dexter. He married a rich widow named Elizabeth Frothingham, achieving some money and status, but not as much as he wanted. He petitioned the town government of Malden to appoint him to a position of power, which annoyed them so much that they eventually granted him a made-up office to shut him up, Informer of Deer. His job was to let people know where the local deer were at all times. He was a reasonably diligent informer of deer, and before long, everyone was fully aware that there were no deer in the Malden area, and there hadn't been for years. Around the time Dexter was fruitlessly searching for deer to inform people of, the Revolutionary War was happening. One mostly forgotten element of the war was that it was accompanied by a financial crisis. Even the musical Hamilton doesn't really emphasize that aspect of American independence, even though Alexander Hamilton made his mark on history, first and foremost, by ending that crisis. The Continental Congress, the interim pseudo-government of the 13 colonies, had begun to print their own currency, the Continental Dollar, as soon as the war started to get going. The banknotes were printed in very weird denominations, including 2/3 of a Continental Dollar, every whole number from 1 through 8, and denominations of 45, 55, and 65 continentals. The lowest value bill was 1/3, and the highest was 80. There were no 10s, no 50s, and no 100s. I have no explanation. The war was, understandably, a huge drain on the new nation's balance sheet, and the cash printers went brrr. At the same time, the wily Brits printed fake continentals and handed them out willy-nilly. Before long, there was crippling hyperinflation. War veterans came back to find that their pay was worthless. To this day, you might hear old people say something is not worth a continental, which isn't a reference to a stale hotel breakfast, it's part of the cultural memory of America's worst struggle with inflation. Against this background, Timothy Dexter decided, or so people say, for reasons he didn't fully explain at the time, to buy up huge quantities of worthless Continental Dollar banknotes. He spent most of his fortune he got from marrying Frothingham on it, so the stories go. But at the same time, the Constitution was ratified, and Alexander Hamilton, as Secretary of the Treasury, announced that he was going to end hyperinflation once and for all by buying back all the Continental banknotes in exchange for 1% of their face value in Treasury bonds. It wasn't much, and nobody got rich off it, except Dexter, who had a spectacular stockpile of Continentals that people had just given him to get them off their hands. He had taken a gamble that nobody thought had any chance of paying off, and he made a ton of money. Dexter had no education and no special insider knowledge that Hamilton was about to do that.
He had made a huge, stupid mistake that somehow multiplied his fortune. And this kept on happening. People who were mad at seeing such an idiot stumble into so much money gave him advice on how to bankrupt himself, disguised as investment tips. They told Dexter to ship bed warming pans to the Caribbean, which he did, earning back almost twice his expenses because locals found a use for them as ladles in molasses refineries. Next, he was instructed to literally sell coal to Newcastle, a major city in northern England that was the biggest coal mining hub in the world at the time. Selling coal to Newcastle is an expression even today, meaning trying to pointlessly give people something that they already have enough of. Dexter, seemingly, had never heard the expression and had a very limited knowledge of the world outside Massachusetts, so he did it. And made money again, because there happened to be a miners' strike there. After his bed warming pan success, he assumed the Caribbean must be very cold, so he sent a shipment of winter clothes. It was picked up, not by the Russian Baltic Fleet, that's still over 100 years later, but by Indian merchants who sold them to Siberia, again at a markup that gave Dexter a profit. He was not above using outrageous strategies to sell his wares. He bought wholesale Bibles cranked out by a Massachusetts press and told people they would go to hell if they didn't buy one. This was New England only a century after the Puritans, and it paid off. Next, Dexter sent a third thing to the Caribbean, the stray cats of Malden, which were becoming a nuisance. He made money in Malden rounding them up, and then made money again selling them to Caribbean sugar farmers to deal with the rats that were eating their crop. He went to Boston and bought 340 tons of whale bones, which whalers were glad to get rid of, and right then, by pure coincidence, the corset trend started to take off. He had cornered the market on what corsets were made of. So, after all this, Dexter started to believe what everyone who coincidentally becomes rich starts to believe, that he was the smartest motherfucker in the world. He bought a colonial Georgian mansion in the seaside village of Newburyport, Massachusetts, and outfitted it in his own personal style, which was as ostentatious and eccentric as he was. He commissioned 40 wooden statues of people he considered to be the greatest in history. The first three US presidents, who were the only ones at the time, Greek philosophers, British generals, a Native American chief, the Haitian slave rebellion leader Toussaint Louverture, and of course, himself. With a plaque below his statue that said, "I am the first in the East, I am the first in the West, and the greatest philosopher in the Western world." When the sculptor wrote on Thomas Jefferson's plaque that he had written the Declaration of Independence, Dexter corrected the poor guy and made him change it to the Constitution, even though Jefferson did not write the Constitution and did write the Declaration of Independence. Dexter hired a fishmonger named Jonathan Plummer to serve as his, quote, poet laureate, so Plummer wrote a bunch of surprisingly not awful poetry extolling Dexter and his wealth. Dexter began calling himself Lord Dexter, Marquis of Newburyport. Dexter came to hate his wife, the one he'd married for her money, to the point that he claimed to houseguests that he was unmarried, and the angry old woman in his house was really a ghost. Still aware that people in Newburyport didn't really take him seriously, he once faked his death to see how people would react. At his funeral, he leapt out of his coffin and began caning his wife because she wasn't crying enough. I mean, for fuck's sake, man, what did you expect? You called her a ghost. As his last-ditch attempt at immortality, Dexter decided that despite having no education and being functionally illiterate, he would write a memoir. And he did. It was called A Pickle for the Knowing Ones, or Plain Truths in a Homespun Dress, and no, I don't know what that's supposed to mean either. The opening lines are, "To mankind at large, the time is come at last, the grat day of rejoicing. What is that? Why, I will tell you, thou's three kings is rast, rast, you mean should know rast, on the first royal arch in the world, almost not quite, but very hew up upon, so they are good mark to be seen, so the woman's lick to see the frount, and all people loves to see them, as the Quakers will come and pee-pee slyly, and feely glad, and say, who the do? Father George Washington is is in the center. King Adams is on the right hand of the present king. The left hand, Father Gorge with his hat on. All the other hats of the middle king with his sword. King Adams with his cane in a grand poster attitude, turning its face toward the first king as if they were on some politic. Now you all know what English sounds like to non-English speakers. The entire 25-page book is one continuous sentence. When Dexter's haters asked him how they were supposed to read the book, given the complete lack of punctuation, Dexter printed a second edition, which concluded with a page of nothing but several rows of every kind of punctuation so that the readers could, quote, pepper and salt it as they please. Here's a question. A problem. A pickle, if you will, for the knowing ones to ponder. How much of this is true? Could Dexter's ridiculous streak of luck have really happened? Was Dexter as much of a blithering idiot as the book he wrote suggested? How much of Dexter's story is shrouded in myth? And if it is mostly myth, where did the myths come from? What was Timothy Dexter really like? I'm your host, Tor Parsons. This is my co-host, Jollibee the Durian, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. Timothy Dexter really existed. There are enough different accounts of his life, his reputation, his palace in Newburyport. We can be sure of that. And he probably really did write A Pickle for the Knowing Ones, or at least someone in his time was trying very hard to make the world think he wrote it. Beyond that, puzzling out exactly what happened in Dexter's life is a pickle in itself. It's not for a lack of information, though. Rather, there's so much information out there about Dexter, it's hard to tell what's true and what's not. The best source I could find on the life and times of Timothy Dexter is the book Timothy Dexter Revisited, a 1960 revision of research mostly done in 1925 by John P. Marquand, a moderately famous novelist and historian from Dexter's hometown of Newburyport. Marquand is known for a lot more than just writing about Timothy Dexter. He put out a successful string of mystery novels in the 1930s and 40s, starring a Japanese detective, Mr. Moto, who was created to counter yellow peril stereotypes about the Japanese around that time. Marquand is probably most famous for his book The Late George Apley, which won him the Pulitzer for Fiction in 1938. George Apley is a satire of the stuffy upper class of Boston in the early 20th century, and it shows that Marquand had a keen eye for the complicated and artificial rules of social class. Marquand was also a talented historical researcher and felt a strong attachment to his Newburyport, Massachusetts roots, so he was pretty much the ideal person to suss out the real story of Timothy Dexter. From poring over pre-Revolutionary War-era sources, Marquand managed to trace Dexter's early life. He was born in Malden, Massachusetts, not far north of Boston, in 1747, to an ordinary 18th-century peasant family. He had no formal education, because only the upper class ever would. As was customary in those days, when Dexter became a teenager and his parents could no longer afford to house him, he took up an apprenticeship and began learning a trade. He moved to Newburyport, not too far away, and was taken in by a leather worker. Everything in Dexter's life beyond this point takes place in Newburyport, not Malden, which isn't really a huge mistake. I don't think anyone really cares which small Massachusetts town this all went down in, but the most popular sources all tend to set Dexter's foibles in Malden, which speaks to bigger issues with fact-checking. What little we do know about Dexter's early days suggests that he was a fairly normal, but also probably uncommonly hardworking, young man. Before long, he had set up his own leatherworking shop in Newburyport, the Sign of the Glove, and the first clear mention of Dexter in the media is from April 1776, when he would be 29, advertising his wares in Newburyport's newspaper, The Impartial Herald. The ad is fluently worded and correctly spelled, maybe meaning he got someone else to write it for him, or more interestingly, suggesting his later public image may have been just a persona. Either way, even before making any outrageous investments, Dexter had already gone not from rags to riches, but rags to a comfortable middle-class, small business-owning life. For his time and place, that isn't too surprising. There was a lot of money in Newburyport in those days. It was reasonable to believe that an enterprising peasant could make a lot more money there than they were used to. Even later on, when Dexter went around calling himself Lord and holding wild parties at his palace, John P. Marquand says that Dexter was never the richest person in the small town of Newburyport. What industry was Newburyport's boom being driven by? Piracy. The Revolutionary War was heating up, and the Continental Congress was literally giving out pirates' licenses. They called it privateering, but it was the same thing. If you had a ship and a crew, you could get an official license from the breakaway government to go out and pillage British ships. The Continental Congress didn't even charge a tax on your loot. You could keep everything you got. It was good enough for them to bust up the British trade routes. Dexter's wife, Elizabeth Frothingham, did exist.
Elizabeth Frothingham.
Records say they got married in 1770 and had two children, Samuel and Nancy. Frothingham really was from an upper-class family, and Dexter really was marrying up the social ladder, but I don't think he was a gold digger. There's not a lot of record of Frothingham being frothingly rich. Dexter kept on running his leather goods shop long after he got married, implying at the very least that he still needed to work to support his family. And Frothingham's family probably wouldn't have approved her marriage to a complete nobody, back in this era when marriages were transactional. All that suggests that even by 1770, just a few years after arriving in Newburyport, Dexter probably had made at least as much money from his leather shop as he got by marrying Frothingham. He probably did move up the social ladder by marrying Frothingham, but it gained him more status than money. Later in 1776, not long after Dexter began putting ads for the Sign of the Glove in the newspaper, we get to the first of many fun, weird parts of his life that have been repeated a million times across the internet. In the Newburyport local elections of 1776, which were still happening even in the face of the ongoing war, Dexter was elected Informer of Deer. That's right, he was elected! Sure, only white male landowners could vote, but it wasn't a fake office he was just appointed to by the town council. Dexter ran for this existing office and won. So, what was an informer of deer? Well, if you look up the phrase informer of deer, the first few pages of Google results are all just unsourced weird history blogs and stuff repeating the legend of Timothy Dexter, saying that it was a meaningless office the town council gave him to shut him up, and that it involved telling people about deer. Or telling deer about people, or sometimes they just throw up their hands and say, what the hell was an informer of deer? Guess we'll never know. But none other than the webpage for the Massachusetts state government tells a different story. Ever since a law passed in 1739, every town in the colony of Massachusetts had to have an informer of deer. They were the first game wardens in what became America. That is, people who regulate what animals you can hunt and when. Some towns called them deer reeves, or informers of deer and moose, since their jurisdiction wasn't limited to deer, but everyone in Massachusetts circa 1776 knew exactly what an informer of deer was. It was a real elected office with real powers, and it took Dexter another step forward on his road to local stardom. Marquand speculates that Dexter ran for informer of deer so he could prove to Frothingham's family that he was a gentleman by doing what gentlemen do and running for office. There's one aspect of Dexter's informer of deer story that is probably true, though. The inevitable punchline that there were no deer anywhere in the area. That didn't make his job useless. That was sort of the point of having an informer of deer. They were created because deer in 18th century New England were becoming rare and overhunted, so they needed someone to enforce a ban on killing deer. According to court records in 1763, if someone shot a deer, not only would they be fined, the local informer of deer would also be fined for allowing it to happen. Over the next few years, Dexter crops up in Newburyport town records a few more times. He's clearly set on making more money, and he does this by investing in surprisingly normal things at this point. His name pops up on a few land speculations up in New Hampshire, possibly obtained through marrying Frothingham. In the mid-1780s, Dexter began hoarding worthless continental banknotes, and this is an element of Dexter's story that lines up reasonably well with all the breathless mythology and history podcasts. The whole story in the intro about the continental currency, its hyperinflation, and Hamilton's decision to buy them back with bonds, that all really happened. And Timothy Dexter, by all accounts, really was one of the few people to get rich off that decision. But he wasn't the only person. In Boston at the time, there were other speculators who predicted that at some point, the government would have to buy back the Continentals. In Newburyport, one Theophilus Parsons, a lawyer and possible distant relative of mine, I don't know. Anyway, Theophilus Parsons was rumored to have advanced knowledge of the government's plans, and Parsons had represented Dexter's shop, the Sign of the Glove, in a legal case otherwise lost to history. So Dexter's decision to buy up mountains of continental banknotes on the cheap wasn't a colossally stupid waste of money that ended up miraculously paying off. It was a gamble, but a clever and calculated one, with a dash of insider trading thrown in. Not that Dexter himself would want you to know this. Years later, writing disjointedly and illiterately about the continental currency crisis, he promoted the "oops, I did something dumb because I'm a dumb, dumb dummy, and instead I got a lot of money" narrative of his life. From the way Dexter wrote about his own life and the way Marquand reconstructed his real life, you start to get a picture of who Dexter really was and who he wanted people to know him as. At first, at least, Dexter put his money into very reasonable investments. In 1790, with the funds he got from the continental currency, Dexter bought a ship, which he called the Mehitabel, an old biblical girl's name that really should come back. Newburyport was becoming a major international harbor as the war subsided, and with the war over and piracy illegal again, Dexter probably used the Mehitabel to buy and sell various things overseas, which may have contributed to the later legends about him. And a lot of those might also be true, but nobody has any idea. Most of the records of imports and exports going through Newburyport were destroyed in a fire in 1811. Let's take these one by one. Selling warming pans to the Caribbean, which ended up getting used as ladles for the industrial production of molasses, is one of the more plausible stories. While Marquand says the size of the shipment was exaggerated by later authors, reaching numbers of warming pans that logistically just wouldn't have been possible for Dexter to send to the Caribbean in the 1790s, he might have sent some pans. The claim that he had done this was already around when Dexter died, unlike a lot of the other stories which didn't pop up until long after his death. Dexter's obit in the Newburyport Impartial Herald mentioned the warming pan story. It's not clear how knowledgeable Dexter really was about the outside world, and maybe he really was hoodwinked, or maybe he intended them as molasses ladles from the start. That's the trouble with anecdotes like these. Supposedly, after that, Dexter sold mittens to the Caribbean, assuming it had to be cold there. This is almost definitely false because there was no big textile industry in America at the time. Mittens were knitted by housewives. They weren't mass-produced. Marquand acknowledges there's the possibility that a shipment of mittens arrived in Newburyport from Europe and were sold to Dexter at a loss, who then made a profit from their sale in the Caribbean to merchants who sent them to Russia, but it's a stretch, and there's no clear origin for this claim from when Dexter was alive. One of the best stories about Dexter is that he literally sold coal to Newcastle because his shipment arrived during a miners' strike. Back when I uncritically accepted the story of Timothy Dexter as true, and I was brainstorming subjects for episodes, I wrote this one on my episode schedule for the Old Tours Cabinet podcast under the working title, The Man Who Sold Coal to Newcastle. Unfortunately, once again, there's no record of this at the time, Nor is there even a mention of it in the first biography of Dexter, written by Newburyport resident Samuel Knapp in 1838. It's a later invention, probably first appearing in an 1858 reprint of Knapp's biography. I couldn't find any evidence of a major strike taking place in Newcastle in the 1790s, the period when Dexter's weirdest speculations all supposedly took place. There was a strike in 1765, but it only lasted a few weeks, and any strike big enough to meaningfully limit the supply of coal in Newcastle would definitely enter the historical record. Besides, England had plenty of other coal mining regions. This hypothetical strike would have to be a really big one for shipping coal from America to become economically viable, and there weren't any nationwide coal strikes in the UK until the rise of modern-day unions in the 1830s. It's kind of obvious that after hearing all the other stories, someone would invent this story about Dexter. Given that the expression sending coal to Newcastle is kind of dying out, I bet that 50 years on, the story will have mutated again, and there'll be people going around saying that Timothy Dexter sold ice to Alaskans, or lava to Hawaiians. The story that Dexter bought huge amounts of whalebone for no real reason, right when the corset craze began to get going, comes directly from Dexter's near-illegible autobiography. Marquand doesn't have evidence to disprove it and acknowledges that it might be true, but like with the Continental Currency, buying all the whalebone in Boston wouldn't have been a random waste of money for the hell of it that ended up turning a profit. Whalebone wasn't only used in corsets. Whalebone was actually the baleen, not the bone, of the whales. Baleen, 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 baleen was the plastic of its time. It was tough, but flexible, so it was used for tools, military helmets, umbrella spokes, buggy wheels, all kinds of things. But then, none of this might be true after all, because the corset trade was collapsing, not booming, in the 1790s when all of this supposedly took place. The main market for corsets had been France, and for obvious reasons, right about then in France, you wouldn't be caught dead wearing something aristocratic like a corset. And you definitely wouldn't want to be caught alive wearing a corset. According to the University of Aberdeen in Scotland, whalebone prices in 1795 were almost a quarter of what they had been in the 1760s. It wasn't a lucky time to be buying up whalebone. It's possible this is the only major investment that Dexter lost money on. But the French Revolution did affect Dexter's life in one way. In 1793, when the French King Louis XVI was executed, there was a huge outpouring of support for old Louis in America. Kind of surprising, since the French Revolution took inspiration from the American one, but the popular opinion in America was that the French Revolution took things too far. By this point, Dexter had sold Sign of the Glove and moved into a huge mansion, although not the one that he would later surround with statues. Dexter was in Boston at this point, buying or selling something that was lost to history, when he heard the news, and he rushed home Paul Revere style to Newburyport to tell everyone. He bribed the sextons of the churches to ring the bells along the way. A crowd gathered on the main street of Newburyport, not knowing what was going on, until Dexter appeared on the front stoop and gave a speech mourning the King of France. The speech went over well, and Dexter loved the attention this brought him. It's not hard to see this as the start of a new chapter in Dexter's life. Whatever the rumors, he hadn't done anything too shocking or weird yet. That was about to change. What do you get for the Revolutionary War era nouveau riche goods trader who has everything? Attention. Later in 1793, one of Dexter's previous investments began to make him some money. A toll bridge across the Merrimack River near Newburyport. Remember, these were the days when the government didn't really do anything. The present-day structure of the US government was designed at a time when almost nothing was provided by the government. The Founding Fathers didn't put a thought toward designing a government that could easily pass legislation because what was there to legislate on? Schools were run by churches. Hospitals, too. Police were ad hoc militias. The poor were going to stay that way. It wasn't the government's job to help them. Even roads were private enterprises. Everything important that a government could do, like keeping track of deer, I guess, could happen at the local level. National governments existed more or less to declare war against other nations. A government that can easily pass laws would be a government that can easily become tyrannical, thought the Founding Fathers, so they created a political system designed for gridlock. That's a tangent, but if you've kept watching Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities this long, you're probably a fan of tangents. A fangent, you could say. So, I regret nothing. Anyway, a bridge. The state of Massachusetts wasn't going to build a bridge across the Merrimack, so Timothy Dexter and a bunch of other Newburyport businessmen pooled their funds to build a toll bridge, in exchange for a cut of the profits from the tolls. Dexter got 110 shares of the bridge profits, which suggests that he actually was respected among the business community of Newburyport. If he had the reputation then that he has now, nobody else who has the money to build a bridge would touch him with a 10-foot pole. Dexter did seem to be trying to get that oddball reputation going, though. When the bridge opened, there was a celebration, nearly all of Newburyport was invited, and Dexter delivered another speech, which Marquand describes thus. Some observers said the speech was incomprehensible. Others said it was truly Ciceronian, that is, on the level of the great Roman speaker Cicero. And still others believed it was delivered in French. Whatever language it was in, Dexter published an English version of it in the next edition of the Newburyport Impartial Herald, and remarkably, it was coherently worded, all spelled correctly, and grammatically correct too. I'd say it's the sort of long-winded optimism that ChatGPT would throw at you if you asked it to write a speech delivered at the opening of a new bridge in 1793. Then, Dexter got weirder. He delighted the townsfolk and horrified his wife by showing off an African lion in his front yard, brought to New York from Senegal as a kitten. Dexter charged 9 pence to see the lion. He fought more and more with Elizabeth, who allegedly beat him. There's no record from his era of him abusing her. He took to calling her his ghost, not in the sense that he was literally trying to claim she was a ghost, but more in the sense that she was haunting him and he wanted her out of his house. They unofficially divorced, with Theophilus Parsons, remember him, drawing up a deed dividing their possessions. Elizabeth kept the house, and Dexter decamped to Chester, New Hampshire, where he lived for a few years. While living in New Hampshire, Dexter continued writing letters to the Impartial Herald, complaining about how bad crime was getting in Newburyport. It was in New Hampshire that people took to calling him Lord Dexter because of his ego, and he happily accepted the title. Dexter returned to Newburyport in 1798 and bought a new mansion, just down the street from the one where his ex-wife still lived. He was clearly still respected because he was re-elected to his old position of informer of deer. But he wanted to be more than just a small-town informer of deer. At long last, we finally got a Timothy Dexter who acted like the modern-day reputation of Timothy Dexter. He decided that if he was a lord now, he needed a poet laureate to sing his praises, and he hired Jonathan Plummer, who was, sure enough, a fishmonger in Newburyport. Plummer was more than just a fishmonger, though. He was also a writer of some talent, selling trashy, violent, and often erotic stories of his own invention. It's possible that he didn't even actually sell fish, and that fishmonger was a euphemism for, like, a porn star. Either way, he was more than capable of being Dexter's poet laureate. And yes, Dexter surrounded the mansion with statues. Breathless reports in the Impartial Herald said that there would be marble likenesses of the Founding Fathers, Greek and Roman mythological figures, the kings and emperors of most countries at the time, the incumbent governors of New Hampshire and Massachusetts, and yes, Dexter himself. Although the existence of a plaque below his statue that called him the greatest philosopher in the Western world probably started as a rumor to mock him years after he died, possibly invented by the classic New England poet Oliver Wendell Holmes, father of the Supreme Court justice by the same name. The statues were made out of wood, for financial reasons, painted white to mimic marble. Dexter really did correct a sculptor for claiming Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, even though he did, and really did make him change it to the Constitution, according to the Impartial Herald. Which, you know, is one thing to make that mistake today, but that was just a few years ago at that point. Something of a Timothy Dexter rat pack began to surround him. He was old, or at least old by 18th century standards. He was in his 50s. He was effectively single, although still legally married to Elizabeth. And he had tons of money. It was time to party. Other Newburyport eccentrics flocked to Dexter's house. A psychic named Madame Hooper, who purportedly had 2 rows of teeth, became his closest confidant. Lucy Lancaster, an apparently extremely tall black woman who claimed descent from African nobility could regularly be found hosting parties at Dexter's mansion. John Marquand's writings on Lucy Lancaster offer an interesting window into the perception of race in colonial America. The upper crust of Newburyport took her claims of royal blood completely seriously and respected her for it. She was a nurse. In fact, one of the most trusted nurses in Newburyport, and she made a fair amount of money. She owned a house where she was the head of household, and she refused to allow any other black people to enter. She didn't really see herself as black, and neither did her contemporaries, because she was wealthy, skilled, generous, and from a noble bloodline, and clearly in 18th century America, black people couldn't be any of those things. What about the story of Dexter faking his death? Did that really happen? Well, yes and no. He held an event that was billed as his funeral and advertised as such in the paper, but he was present at the quote-unquote funeral and very obviously not dead. Nobody got caned for not being sad enough. It was really just to show off his construction of a swanky glass mausoleum in his backyard. Unfortunately, Dexter never got to be buried in it. By the early years of the 19th century, Dexter was suffering from gout and other nasty, largely extinct diseases, having to be tended to constantly by Lucy Lancaster, who may have also been his mistress at this point. His fortune, probably acquired in less interesting ways than people think, finally began running out. He began selling off his wooden statues, which were already rotting from the New England rain and snow, to pay off the debts his wild parties had amassed. Eventually, he sold his whole estate, and its next owner removed all the eccentricities Dexter had added. He published A Pickle for the Knowing Ones to set the record straight on how he wanted to be remembered. Those who remembered his well-written letters to the Impartial Herald were baffled. A few years later, in 1806, at age 59, Timothy Dexter died in Newburyport. His estate was valued at less than $1 million in today's money, and less than $100,000 in 1806 money, a huge drop from his glory days. His house still stands, but it looks like any other genteel colonial-era mansion. Not a trace of Dexter's years as Marquis of Newburyport survives. Dexter reveled in his image as something of an 18th-century Tommy Wiseau. In fact, that's a surprisingly direct comparison. He wanted people to know him as an eccentric, exuberant, socially awkward weirdo who had an unpredictable command of English and, despite not seeming to be particularly smart, went from poverty to having a mysteriously acquired multi-million-dollar fortune. That's who he wanted to be. In real life, he was an 18th century equivalent of a fairly ordinary businessman, you know? Like your uncle who retired at 50 because he made some lucky investments flipping houses or something. But nobody's gonna remember your uncle for that long after his death. Timothy Dexter recognized that weirdos are immortal. So he put himself in the historic record as a weirdo. He may have made himself a fortune from nothing, but plenty of hardworking people do that with some luck. Timothy Dexter consciously made himself a legacy from nothing, and that's more impressive than shipping coal to Newcastle. The way he's remembered now is exactly what he would have wanted. The following poem was written by Jonathan Plummer and displayed in the Newburyport Impartial Herald when Dexter died. Lord Dexter is a man of fame, most celebrated is his name, more precious far than gold that's pure. Lord Dexter shines forevermore. His noble house, it shines more bright than Lebanon's most pleasant height. Never was one who stepped therein who wanted to come out again. Kind of sinister. His house is filled with sweet perfumes. Rich furniture doth fill his rooms. Inside and out it is adorned, and on the top an eagle formed. His house is white and trimmed with green. For many miles it may be seen. It shines as bright as any star. The fame of it has spread afar. Lord Dexter, thou, whose name alone shines brighter than King George's throne, thy name shall stand in books of fame, and princes shall his name proclaim. Lord Dexter hath a coach beside, in pomp and splendor he doth ride. The horses champ the silver bit, and throw the foam around their feet. The images around him stand, for they were made by his command. Looking to see Lord Dexter come, with fixed eyes, they see him home. Four lions stand beside the door, with mouths wide open to devour all enemies who oppose Lord Dexter or his shady groves. Lord Dexter, like King Solomon, hath gold and silver by the ton, and bells to churches he hath given to worship the great King of Heaven. His mighty deeds, they are so great, he's honored both in church and state. And when he comes, all must give way to let Lord Dexter bear the sway. When Dexter dies, all things shall droop. Lord East, Lord West, Lord North shall stoop, and then Lord South with pomp shall come and bear his body to the tomb. Might have been pronounced differently at that point. His tomb, most charming to behold, 1,000 sweets it doth unfold. When Dexter dies, shall willows weep, and mourning friends shall fill the street. May Washington forever stand. May Jefferson, by God's command, support the right of all mankind. John Adams, not a whit behind. America, with all your host, Lord Dexter, in a bumper toast. May he enjoy his life in peace, and when he's dead, his name not cease. In heaven may he always reign, for there's nor sorrow, sin, or pain. Unto the world I leave the rest, for to pronounce Lord Dexter best.